Into the Bad Quaker podcast, where liberty is our mission. Today is Monday, September 23rd, 2013. This is podcast number 347, and my name is Ben Stone. Please excuse my voice. As you can hear, I've been fighting with this cold now for 4 or 5 days, and I'm going to do the best I can with it. I have two quick things I want to put in the announcements here. Bitcoin Not Bombs needs your help to hoodie the homeless. Mass Appeal, Inc. has offered us a great deal on 324 discounted orange hoodies that will be distributed to the homeless in San Francisco. We have until the end of October to raise 47 Bitcoin needed to reach our goal, and we're calling on the Bitcoin community to help make this happen. You can pledge contributions to the Bitcoin Starter Campaign, purchase a Bitcoin Not Bombs t-shirt, or donate to Bitcoin Not Bombs directly. Every t-shirt sold is priced to pay for one hoodie to keep someone warm this winter. Go to BitcoinNotBombs.com and help us hoodie the homeless. Tomorrow on the show, I'm going to have Ademo Friedman, and Ademo is going to talk to us about Sons of Liberty Mint. And when you hear the commercial today in today's show for Sons of Liberty Mint, don't be worried. We still have a relationship with Magi Metals. Magi Metals is also helping with the programs there that with Sons of Liberty Mint that we're trying to do. So in a commercial break, you're going to hear Ernie Hancock's voice talking about Sons of Liberty Mint. And be sure and get over there, because you have the opportunity to get free silver. How often do you have the opportunity to have free silver? I mean, who would turn down free silver? I've never walked up to anybody and said, hey, would you like some free silver? And they had shook their head and say, no, I don't want that. So listen to that commercial, do what it says, and get yourself some free silver. Now to the real business today. We have a very special guest, James Corbett from the Corbett Report, also from BoilingFrogsPost.com. And James is the host of the Boiling Frogs Post Eye Opener Report. If you're not familiar with James Corbett's work, you might be familiar with a YouTube video that he did. It's called 9/11, A Conspiracy Theory. And the subtitle is Everything You Ever Wanted to Know About the 9/11 Conspiracy Theory in Under 5 Minutes. And I'll tell you, it's absolutely the best video on YouTube in reference to 9/11. It's only 5 minutes long. It doesn't wander off into, all kinds of different things. It doesn't try to put any kind of conjecture. It just lays out what is actually the government's argument or the government's story on 9/11. And then it lets you decide, is that really what you believe? So I want to encourage you to get to badquaker.com, hit the link there, and take 5 minutes out of your day and watch this video. It's really good. James, welcome to badquaker.com, and welcome to the podcast. I really appreciate you coming on the show with me.
Well, thank you very much for that generous introduction. I only hope I can live up to it. But while we're on the note of 9/11, a conspiracy theory, it has had over 2 million views on my YouTube channel alone. And I've had a lot of requests over the years from some of the fans of that video to have it on DVD. So I should let your listeners know if they do enjoy it. I have actually just released a DVD that they can buy that actually has that on it. And I encourage people to take all of my DVDs that are available from CorbettReport.com and burn them and make copies and pass them out to your friends and neighbors and complete strangers, because that's the only way we can really continue to get this word out, is to spread it as far and wide as possible. So I'm doing my part to try to get this offline as well as online.
One of the most interesting things I think that really struck me in that video is that there was a plan to invade Afghanistan on Bush's desk 7 days before September 11th, 2001 attack.
Just to be clear, that wasn't in that 9/11 a conspiracy theory video per se, but it has been in a few of my videos and podcasts in the past. And this is a fascinating little tidbit that I really wish more people knew about. It's called NSPD-9. It's the National Security Presidential Directive 9, which was the first major national security initiative of the Bush administration that was planned for in the months prior to 9/11. And basically, it was the entire battle plan for the invasion of Afghanistan, including command and control and logistics and air support, ground support, everything was laid out in that document. It was there on the president's desk waiting to be signed September 4th, 2011, exactly 1 week before 9/11. And, well, the rest is history. But, of course, it was just the end point of a years-long buildup towards war with Afghanistan that was related to some disputes that were going on through Unocal and other interested companies in a trans-Afghanistan pipeline that was being basically blocked by the Taliban. And there was a point during the negotiations, I believe it was in August of 2001, certainly it was shortly before 9/11, where one of the U.S. negotiators said, well, we'll get this pipeline through by a carpet of gold or a carpet of bombs. And lo and behold, later that year, they were invading Afghanistan, exactly as was laid out in this document that was on the president's desk a week before 9/11. So it's interesting how these pieces just happen to fall in place just before this spectacular terrorist attack justifies the invasion.
Being a really, really old person like I am, I remember when the Soviet Union invaded Afghanistan, and I remember how shocked Jimmy Carter was that that this had taken place. And he came on and did a television announcement of how shocked he was that the Soviet Union would do this. And even then, you know, at that age that I was, I think I was about 18 or something like that at the time, 20 maybe. And I thought, how could he be shocked? Is his intelligence really, you know, I'm talking about the intelligence community. Are they really so out of touch that they didn't know the Soviet Union had been planning this for a long time? And then I think now about 9/11, and it's kind of this, it's exactly the same story just given to us by a different government that, you know, oh, we were just walking along one day and all of a sudden this happened. Now we've got to go invade Afghanistan. It's like governments play the same tune, no matter which government they are, and people just buy the story.
Well, let me blow another cover off of that story for you and maybe add something that you didn't know about. But in 1998, Zbigniew Brzezinski, who was Carter's national security advisor, gave an interview to a French periodical called Le Nouvel Observateur, where he happened to spill the beans on the fact that that not only did Carter and the gang know about the Russian invasion of Afghanistan beforehand, they actually made it happen on purpose. They were actually funding the insurgency, the people who were trying to overthrow the communist-friendly government in Afghanistan in 1979 before the Soviets invaded. It was actually a trap to get the Soviets to invade. And Zbigniew Brzezinski just let that out of the bag in this interview in 1998 that didn't get a lot of notice until some people in the 9/11 truth community started to bring it to other people's attention. But yes, that was a phony setup too, and they were lying at that time as well.
My wife and I were up in the northeast U.S., oh, I don't know, this was 6 months ago or so, and I saw an interesting thing on local TV. They were talking about a problem in the Boston area with people, these crazy radicals that were climbing way out on overpasses and really places that are hard to get to, and they were tagging, you know, spray can painting things like Google Building 7 and 9/11 was a setup and things like this that they're you know, they're putting up as graffiti around in different places in the Boston area. And I thought, you know, I'm not for damaging any private property. I'm against damaging anyone's private property. But I thought, wow, this is getting to the point of where taggers, kids, are risking their lives climbing out on overpasses to tag this, to let people know, to wake people up and let them know there's something here you need to look at.
Well, that does go to, I think, prove the point that this is an exceptionally foundational type of events. I mean, obviously, I think no one can look at what happened on 9/11 and think that this doesn't in many ways define the era that we're living in. And of course, it's defined that era for in different ways for different people. But I think for people like myself, who unfortunately did completely buy into the official narrative hook, line, and sinker for the first 5 years after the event, when it actually does hit you that you've been lied to consistently and constantly and consciously with malice aforethought by the government that was supposed to be giving the official narrative and telling you exactly what happened, once that really hits you and the implications of that hits you, it's a pretty life-altering event. It certainly was for me, and that was one of the things that spurred me into starting my own website. And once you start, unfortunately, going down that rabbit hole, it goes much, much deeper. But it is one of those events that I think certainly has motivated an entire generation of people to become more politically motivated than what we saw, obviously, in the 1990s with just the complete apathy, perhaps epitomized by the Seinfeld era or whatever it was of just total political disengagement among youth that really turned around in the past decade. And that's, I suppose, one of the silver linings to the clouds of what's happened in this past decade. We've certainly seen a lot more people wake up to the real political issues of our time and the dire need for direct political engagement on these extremely important issues. But of course, attendant with that comes all of the police state apparatus and everything that we've seen being built up in the wake of 9/11 as well. So it seems like it's a race between tyranny and liberty, and unfortunately, tyranny has a head start.
You have recently talked about learned helplessness, and I think that's really kind of what was happening during the 90s. There was this general feeling among people that the whole system is out of control. There's nothing I can do about it, so I'm just going to bury my head and pretend it doesn't exist.
That's right. Well, learned helplessness is a fascinating concept, and it comes from a series of experiments that were conducted in the last century by people like, I believe his name was Martin Seligman. It was Seligman at any rate, who did a series of experiments on different animals, including dogs, in which, for example, dogs were put in a situation where they were on a floor that had been electrified so that it could pass an electric shock through the dog. And when they did this in a situation where the dog could just jump out of the way of the shock, it would feel the shock and it would jump away and it would escape it would escape the area that was electrified. Eventually, they would put in a barrier so that the dog could not jump out of the way of the shock. It just had to basically take it. There was nothing it could do. And they found that if a dog was subjected to that type of shock for long enough that it could not avoid, eventually, even if they took away the barriers, so all it had to do was jump out of the way and it could get out of that area and it could avoid the shock, it actually wouldn't do it. It would actually just sit down and take the shock because it had been conditioned into the idea that there was nothing it could do. So it was a type of learned helplessness. It was conditioned to simply feel helpless, to be helpless, and to stop acting, to do anything to avoid this unpleasurable sensation. And I think that it's not much of a stretch to see how that can apply to the populace generally and to our political situation in particular, especially in these developed Western democracies where, generally speaking, I mean, the United States is the worst example of this, but I think it's true more or less to the similar extent in all of the major Western democracies. There's only ever really two choices on the table at any given election, and those two choices are always pre-selected and basically just different slices of the same cake anyway, and it's a one big poison cake. So unfortunately, I think the voters in these basically tax farms have discovered the fact that basically they're like the dog and they're in that little box and there's nothing they can do to avoid the shocks that come. So more and more people have just taken to lying down and taking them. Well, there's nothing we can do. There's no hope. We might as well just take the shocks and just enjoy it. And unfortunately, there's also a percentage of the population that will actually learn to love the people who are shocking them. This is a phenomenon called Stockholm Syndrome, which unfortunately, as I went over in a recent podcast episode, also applies to a certain percentage of the population. So I think that there are a lot of psychological tricks that are used in order to basically keep the population in this state of complete helplessness, of basically abject inaction. And this is one of the defining defining schisms in our society today. There are the people who have decided that what's going on is unacceptable and that that has motivated them to start taking action and doing things and spreading information and awareness and engaging people on these issues. And then there's another section of the population that has decided that there's nothing that can be done. It might as well just take the shocks and lay down. And I think we're becoming more and more a divided society along those lines.
Yeah, in your show that you did about the Stockholm syndrome and learned helplessness, it, as I was listening to that, it was reminding me of two male relatives that I have, both about the same age, both Vietnam veterans, both had, you know, similar careers after they were in the military, and they have reacted to everything that we see in society in two different ways, even though they have almost identical backgrounds. One of them just sort of a few years ago got into a situation where all he could do to keep his sanity literally was to turn off the TV, never ever watch any news, even local news, and just essentially, you know, he went on a farm in Kentucky and he just keeps to himself and he doesn't want to hear about what's going on. He doesn't want to talk about what's going on. He just wants to, you know, take care of his dogs, take care of his chickens, you know, talk to his wife, mow the yard. And that's his way of his method of self-defense in this. The other person, same age, same life experiences, is absolutely fanatically committed. His level of love for the U.S. government, and I use that word specifically, his level of love for the U.S. government just makes it very hard for me to even be in his presence. It's so disgusting. And I see these two guys and the way they've reacted to what has been presented to them over the years. And it's like an actual, you know, mirror image of what you described with the Stockholm syndrome or the learned helplessness.
Unfortunately so, and I think we can all probably relate to that. I think there's people in our lives who have had similar coping mechanisms. And basically, at the end of the day, these are coping mechanisms for the same problem. And I think probably your listeners and people who follow the alternative media do understand what these problems are and the roots of them. But unfortunately, for a certain percentage of the population, that's just going to lead them to completely disengage. And then another percentage of the population is going to make them decide just mentally to go along with it because it's easier to go along to get along. And that leaves an even smaller percentage of the population, a vanishingly small slice of that pie of people who are aware of what's happening and still motivated and engaged to try to do something about it. And it is an overwhelming task. I mean, I would be disingenuous if I was going to say that I wasn't disheartened at times and if it didn't always constantly seem like an uphill struggle to try to affect change. But then again, if I didn't believe that that was possible, I wouldn't be here talking to you right now and I wouldn't have a website and I wouldn't be doing a podcast and I wouldn't be doing any of this. So I guess at some level, I believe that change is still possible, and that window of opportunity may be closing for a myriad of reasons, including all of the basically scientific craft for trying to control the populace that is being refined even as we speak. But while this window of opportunity of resistance exists, I'm going to try to make the most of it and hopefully try to motivate others to join me in that struggle.
Now, you talk about this window of opportunity, and it's very similar to things I've talked about as well. I feel like we have a very short period of time where we can either make something happen or we're going to dump it off onto another generation. And it may go hundreds of years before they have another opportunity like this. I do a lot of studying of history, and I've seen spots in history where something could have been done to derail this process, or something was done and it derailed it for maybe a generation or two. And then, you know, the powers that be were able to bring it back into this process, into this direction again. But I think that within the next, you know, I hate to put a time frame on it, but maybe as little as the next 20 to 50 years, if something isn't done to alter the direction that humanity is going on, we're going to go into some type of a permanent or semi-permanent mental enslavement to these people, because it's just, you know, it's just so systematic their ability to use the mainstream media and all the little mind tricks that they've come up with to manipulate, you know, the herds. You were also talking about gaslighting, which is a fascinating topic.
That's right. For people who don't know, that term comes from it was a 1940 British film. It was remade in the United States a few years later. And that United States, the American version, was the one that became more popular. But the original 1940 British version was based on a play that I think was first staged in 1938. It's basically about a husband who is trying to trick his wife into believing that she's insane as part of a dastardly setup for a robbery. But it's an interesting movie. It's actually a very interesting film, so I hope people will go and watch it. It's actually available for free download off of archive.org, so people can watch it today if they want. But the idea is that when you gaslight somebody, you play little tricks on them. It might be something really innocuous at first. It might just mean that you hide one of their items and then try to convince them that they lost it, and that can be done pretty easily, I think, because most people wouldn't suspect that you were going around and hiding their items on them or things like that. And it eventually increases from there until the person starts to really question their own sanity, and it can get to a point where a person is being completely manipulated and their life is more or less destroyed because there is someone basically trying to play on their natural innocence when it comes to these things, the trusting nature that most of us have, especially when it comes to loved ones. So especially if it's someone in a loving relationship, like a spouse or a family member or something that's doing this to another person, that can be especially damaging. So it's a fascinating concept. And unfortunately, I think there are ways that we can see also apply that to our greater societal position when we start to think of the ways that we are all being gaslit by the societal controllers, if you want to put it that way. And in the podcast where I was talking about this, my guest, Thomas Sheridan, who has written a number of books on psychopathy, he was giving some examples of how this works culturally, for example, with something like Miley Cyrus at the Video Music Awards, which I'm sure everyone is sick of hearing about. But that's in some ways precisely the point, is that we have become a society that continues to tune in, you know, year after year to these increasingly outrageous and just plain silly, really, Video Music Awards and the like, things of completely no consequence whatsoever, somehow expecting that this year it's going to be different, that somehow this year it's not going to be some outrageous, silly, shocking act that's meant to basically outrage us all. And to a certain extent, this is a type of gaslighting, that we've been somehow tricked into believing that these cute little Mickey Mouseketeers will grow up to be anything other than the next fill in the blank, Christina Aguilera and or Miley Cyrus and or Lady Gaga or what have you. And that's just one of the cultural aspects of this. Of course, it's much more insidious when we think of the political aspects. And one example I like to go back to is when Karl Rove told a reporter several years ago that basically we control reality, and we will do things, we will act in ways that you won't understand. And while you're still trying to put together the pieces of what we've done, we will move on and do something else. We create realities, and you are just there to study them in our wake. So I think that ultimately what we're seeing is that these are there is a certain class of basically psychotic manipulators who, unfortunately, just by the way that the system is designed, do rise to the top because of their very ruthlessness and their propensity to manipulate others. And we could look at the different aspects of that psychologically and why and how that plays out, and psychopathy and the complete lack of empathy for other human beings and the complete lack of normal human emotions and things of that sort. And there are physiological and biological reasons for that. But I think it's important for us to understand that that persists, and that unfortunately in the system that we're in, those types of psychopaths do tend to rise to the positions of power. So we would be naive to think that anyone who is in that position of power doesn't want to rule over other people. I mean, it's often been said that the only politician that you could ever trust is one that doesn't want to be a politician. And of course, that is the catch-22. And that's why unfortunately, things seem to get worse and worse with each generation because they take it one step farther each generation, and we descend one rung on that ladder down into the depths of tyranny. Unfortunately, as you're talking about, I think that we are moving closer and closer towards that permanent tyranny, which is capable increasingly within their grasp, I think, because of the scientific means of control and manipulation that are being developed right now. And you talk about, of course, the mental weapon delivery system that is the television claptrap new idiot box, which has certainly taken us quite a ways down that ladder. But it's getting even worse, and I think the manipulation is getting even more sophisticated. And of course, there's biochemical attacks. There's all sorts of things that are happening on the societal level that people are only dimly aware of, and even when they're made aware of them, tend to be incredulous at the idea. So it doesn't really matter how many studies come out proving that that toddlers and infants that are exposed to television tend to develop language later, tend to do worse at school, tend to have higher crime rates and the like. All of these studies have been done, and still parents will put their children down in front of a television for the first few years of their life, which is just inconceivable to me as a newfound father. Or we can look at the studies, for example, a recent Harvard study that came out as a synthesis of dozens of different peer-reviewed studies proving that fluoride in the water has a direct effect on IQ, a negative inverse effect, so that the more the more fluoridated a water supply is, the more it reduces one's IQ. And yet Americans will still tend to believe that that's some sort of crazy conspiracy theory, despite the fact that America is one of the only countries in the world that actually fluoridates their water supply. But it's been so ingrained into the people that it's just good for your teeth. That's why we do it. And I think we can look at that in a number of different ways. But unfortunately, I think we are descending further and further towards that permanent enslavement that can come through. I think the final barrier, the final threshold is simply the act of resistance. If they can get us to stop believing in resistance, or even being able to think in terms of resistance, then I think that's basically game over. And we can look at the cycles of history and how there has been descents into tyranny and then flowering of liberty and that cycle going around. But unfortunately, if we look at the scientific methods of control, it's certainly possible that that cycle will be stopped at some point, and stopped on the wrong side, unfortunately.
Yeah, it's really odd. I don't want to go too far down this direction, but it's really odd when you mention fluoride to someone and their eyes gloss over and they think immediately, you know, they think you're a nut. But the one question that I generally bring up is, can you name for me or show me how to find even just one study that shows that fluoridation in the water helps your teeth? It just one scientific study to show me that. And of course it doesn't exist. And sometimes that'll make a person think about it. But even then, most people, you know, they just immediately, they hear the word fluoride and they think you're a nut. They think of, you know, some Stanley Kubrick movie or something.
Exactly what I was going to say. The first thing they will tell you, 9 times out of 10, they're going to say something about purity of essence and make a joke out of it. And, I mean, that goes to show the cultural conditioning that people are under right there, because I can't tell you how many times I've had that exact conversation where if I dare to raise the issue of fluoride, it will turn into a purity of essence and they'll laugh about it. So it's really bizarre to see how people are even under mind control about the things that they're being manipulated about.
I can't remember who it was that you quoted recently that said something like something to the effect of if we can inject children and keep them in school, indoctrinated in school, that essentially by the time they get out of school, they won't be able to think for themselves. I can't remember who you were quoting with that.
That was Bertrand Russell, the darling of the progressive community in the, well, early and mid-20th century. In 1953, he was writing about scientific societies, and he said, scientific societies are as yet in their infancy. It is to be expected that advances in physiology and psychology will give governments much more control over individual mentality than they have now, even in totalitarian countries. Fichte laid it down that education should aim at destroying free will so that after pupils have left school, they shall be incapable throughout the rest of their lives of thinking or acting otherwise than as their schoolmasters would have wished. Diet, injections, and injunctions will combine from a very early age to produce the sort of character and the sort of beliefs that the authorities consider desirable, and any serious criticism of the powers that be will become psychologically impossible, which I think pretty much sums it up in a nutshell of exactly what we're talking about and the ways that even half a century ago, over half a century ago, this was already being discussed by the eminent and learned progressives of that time. And another notable example of that was Aldous Huxley, who gave a speech in 1962 called The Ultimate Revolution. It was one of his last public speaking engagements where he talked about some of the experiments that he'd actually already seen of implanting electrodes into people's brains in order to produce changes in their character, etc. And he was talking about how one day it will be possible to make people actually to enjoy their servitude. And you could almost hear the relish in his voice as he was talking about it. And when you start to look into Aldous Huxley and the fact that he was the brother of Julian Huxley, who was one of the founders of UNESCO, who put in the founding documents of UNESCO that we have to make eugenics a scientifically redeemable, we have to redeem eugenics for the next generation of scientists, and his connections to the World Wildlife Fund and all of that kind of shenanigans. The Huxley family, it runs deeply into this this class of would-be societal controllers and manipulators, social engineers, if you will, that I think he was speaking from a lot of personal experience there. But this is a lot of the suppressed history that for some reason or other we weren't taught about in our school. And I wonder why that is, that they don't talk about these types of issues when we're sitting there in those government indoctrination camps.
Folks, we're going to break right here for a commercial, and stick with us. We'll be right back.
What's better than silver? Free silver, of course, which is what you'll get by partaking in Sons of Liberty Mint's weekly silver giveaways. It's fun, it's easy, and it's your chance to win 4 fine silver quarters. That's 1 ounce of 0.999 fine silver from Sons of Liberty Mint. All you have to do is guess the close of spot price each week for your chance to win. Visit sonsoflibertymint.com/contest for more details. That's S-U-N-S, sonsoflibertymint.com.
Energy, vitality, clarity of mind, and incredible immune support. The awesome power of nature is now in your hands. Hi, this is Sean from One with Nature. Our herbal formulas contain some of the greatest botanicals from around the world, and they are ready and willing to help you achieve your goals. Visit us at onewithnature.com. That's W-O-N with nature.com.
And folks, thanks for sticking with us through the break. Ben Stone with James Corbett of the Corbett Report. James, you know, we were talking before the break about gaslighting, and there was something I was thinking about with that. You know, one of the goals of gaslighting is to get the victim to the point of where they no longer accept their own thoughts and their own perception of reality, and they just entirely trust the handler with what reality is. And no matter what they see with their eyes, or no matter what they think they remember, they'll reject that and accept what the handler tells them is reality. And we see this so often, you know, with the different horrible tragedies that take place, the different shootings that take place, or like the Boston, I think the Boston bombing situation is a perfect example of that, where in the aftermath, when they were, you know, chasing the brothers and this whole mess was happening, the story was changing dramatically. Big pieces of fake information were thrown at us and then taken away like it never happened. And the story changed so often. And it, to me, that was exactly like the 9/11 story. You know, with 9/11, we got hit with a story, and then that was rejected. We got hit with another story, and then that was rejected. And over, there were pieces of this that were put up in our face. And we looked at it like the magic wallet, the magic, you know, passport being found or whatever it was of one of the hijackers. And that story was thrown out like it happened. And then all of a sudden nobody talked about it anymore. Like, oh, well, we're not going to try to claim that really happened. But that was, it was an absolute, situation of gaslighting where one reality was presented and then a different reality was given to us to learn about. How often do you think that this kind of thing goes on with us? Is it a constant with every single event, or do you think it's something that they think of after the event takes place, and then they just utilize that situation when it happens?
I think there are it's different for each situation. I mean, I wouldn't want to characterize everything with one broad brush, but I think that certainly that the ability to control the narrative of events has changed drastically in the last decade or two. And I think we're dealing with a completely different information paradigm than existed even just a couple of decades ago. And that is sort of changing the ways that these spectacular events are unfolding before our eyes. And we could think back, I mean, half a century ago now, 50 years ago, it was the assassination of JFK. And at that time, I mean, think about how controlled the flow of information to the public was about that event. I mean, we, from our present day vantage point, think of the Kennedy assassination, and we can probably all picture the actual moment of seeing his head being blown off in a Zapruder film. But it's important to remember that that film was, of course, not seen by the general public until, I believe it was in the 1970s, when I think it was Geraldo first played it on television. And most of the nation saw it for the first time because it had been under lock and key for most of that time. So basically, the characterization of what happened that day was still very much shaped by the people in the media who were simply talking about what they saw, including, of course, the famous pronouncement by, I want to say, Dan Rather. Was it Dan Rather who said his head moved violently forward?
Yeah.
When, of course,
yeah,
that's the exact opposite of what really happened, but we didn't find out about that until decades later. So I think that we are dealing with a different paradigm now, where even if we think back to 9/11, it was still relatively uncommon for people to be walking around with a video camera of some sort. I mean, there were camcorders, obviously, but people weren't generally walking around with them. We now live in an era where pretty much everyone has a video recording device sitting there in their pocket in the form of a cell phone. So we are moving into an era where everyone is becoming sort of a reporter on the scene, and we're getting instant, unfiltered information via Twitter and the like from various places. And I think we'd have to be naive to think that there aren't manipulations that go on with regards to the social media in order to try to influence our perception of events. But all the same, I think it's much more difficult to try to control and craft the narrative in the way that I think has been enjoyed in the past and has happened time and time again in spectacular terrorist type events or events that have shaped public's opinions and perceptions. So I think that to a certain extent, what we've seen recently with events like the Boston bombing and many others that have taken place in the last several years, I think we're seeing this kind of more confusion coming out in the early parts of these narratives that are facilitated by the fact that there's a lot of contradictory information to sort through. And I think it's just not as easy for them to simply come up with one narrative throughput that they can just put across. I think it has to be more nuanced these days. And to a certain extent, that is definitely for the good, because I think that the quick rush to judgment that happens in the wake of these big events is the obviously the vehicle by which they're able to rush through things like, for example, of course, the Patriot Act in the wake of 9/11.
Yeah, which more and more people are understanding that the Patriot Act didn't, you know, spring out of nothing. It was not an ex nihilo type event that took place in September of 2001. That was something that was pre-planned, had been sitting there waiting for the moment to bring it on us. It wasn't at all a new thing.
It certainly wasn't. In fact, Joe Biden even brags that he had helped draft one of the precursors to the Patriot Act, which was the 1995 Counterterrorism Act. I can't remember the full name of the bill, but that was introduced in the wake of the Oklahoma City bombing. And Biden went on to brag, yeah, it was basically the forerunner to the Patriot Act. And no, it certainly did not spring out of nothing. And perhaps worryingly, we had Lawrence Lessig, the copyright professor lawyer, talk recently, just in the last few years, about the fact that there is now a Cyber Patriot Act, an iPatriot Act, that is sitting on the shelves waiting for an Internet 9/11 so that they can bring in the complete control of the internet. And the way things are heading right now, it looks like maybe they don't even have to wait for that I-9/11 to occur, because unfortunately we've already got congressmen and senators of various stripes calling for a more Chinese-style internet. In fact, it was not Biden. I can't think at the moment which senator it was, but a prominent senator was on CNN just a few years ago calling for it, saying that, well, they have a lot of controls on the internet in China, and I think we need to start looking at that type of system.
Wow. You know, we haven't even gotten to the main thing that I wanted to talk to you about, which was the death of Michael Hastings. But before we do talk about that, I wanted to bring up that, you know, a lot of us 5 or even 10 years ago were talking about how, you know, the NSA is spying on people, and we were trying to explain these things years ago, and we were pretty much to a large extent, what we were saying was just discounted, like, well, it's just more craziness from those same people, those, you know, those fluoride people. It's just more craziness from them. And then the leaks start coming through, and we start to find out these things in more of an official tone, and people can now literally not understand that they do intercept every single phone call. They listen to everything. They're, even if they're not specifically listening to it, they're recording it. They're making a copy of it that they can always go back to. And this is what many of us were saying years ago. And now it's been proven. It's been true. And I think the same thing with other things that we're seeing that many people have been talking about that sound really, really crazy and radical on the surface. But then with a little bit more time, you know, the facts start coming in and more things start to make sense. And you're stuck in that situation where you either have to hide your eyes or you have to open your eyes and face what it is that we're dealing with. But going back to the Michael Hastings thing, you did a really good show on that. And I want to put a link to that in today's show notes. Folks need to take a look at that. But essentially, what we're talking about with Michael Hastings is that he was a reporter who had done some really important work and really had shaken up some of the top people in government. And then all of a sudden, he's dead. And we can just explain it by saying, oh, well, there was a car wreck. And then as the story unfolds about the car wreck, the camera slowly pans over and shows a bottle of beer or a beer bottle laying on the side of a curb, and the inference is there that, well, that's what happened. Even though he wasn't drinking, and the tests have shown that he wasn't drinking, still, even in his autopsy, they mention the fact that, well, there were discarded beer containers near the scene. Like he's driving 100 miles an hour down the road, throwing out beer containers and then rams into a tree. You know, even though they're not saying that, that's the sort of gaslight image that they're putting on us.
And yes, and unfortunately it extends even further, where they mentioned that in the autopsy there was traces of amphetamines in his system, although they were not contributory to the accident, is the official ruling. And yet, of course, that was immediately translated into the headlines that Michael Hastings was on meth, and that explains why he was driving like a maniac, basically, is the narrative that was put out there. And of course, that's not what the coroner's report said at all. It was talking about amphetamines, which could have come from any number of sources, even over-the-counter cold medications and the like. So there's absolutely no basis for all of the crazy headlines that came out in the wake of that, but those are just some of the aspects of this case, and it's been a very twisty, turny case in a lot of different ways. And there's been some really reprehensible attempts to debunk the so-called quote-unquote crazy conspiracy theories by establishment rags like the LA Weekly and the like that have talked about this, and they're at pains to point out a few weeks ago that in fact there's no indication that Hastings was actually under any investigation by the FBI and he had been acting erratically and blah blah blah. And then lo and behold, just a couple of weeks ago, Jason Leopold came out in a report that was filed with Al Jazeera September 9th. FBI continues to investigate Hastings for controversial reporting, and it shows that under some FOIA requests that he'd done for FBI information on Hastings, there was at least one document that showed that there was material relating to a pending criminal investigation of Michael Hastings by the FBI. Although most of the information is redacted, and even the title of the document is redacted. I mean, there's basically almost no information whatsoever, but we do know that there was something related to a pending criminal investigation of Hastings by the FBI, exactly as he said in his panicked emails just hours before his death, warning his friends and coworkers that I'm being investigated by the FBI. I have to get off the radar. And so I'm going to be going away soon. And well, unfortunately, he went away forever in a fiery, flaming crash that ejected the engine of his brand new Mercedes, 100 feet away in a giant fireball that was captured on at least one CCTV camera that people can go and watch the explosion that occurred. And I mean, there's no part of this a story that adds up in any way that spells just random accident. I mean, every single step along the way, there are really important questions that need to be answered. But unfortunately, just another indication, I think, of how staged this event was. Of course, within the first few hours, it had already been reported that, well, they suspect no foul play, and that's basically it. And that's when the mainstream basically shut off. But luckily, there have been some alternative researchers that continue to take a look at some of those strange aspects of the story.
When one of the mainstream reporters was talking about the fireball, they tried to explain the unusual event by saying, well, you know, right before he hit the tree, he hit a
sprinkler head thing. Yeah.
Yeah. And you can see the water shooting up in the background behind the car where this took place. And my immediate reaction was to go on Google Earth and zoom in on the spot where this took place. And there are no fire hydrants on that street. Whatever caused that water to come up through the ground, something happened on the surface of the street that put a shockwave so severe that it broke the water pipe underneath there and sent the engine of that car 100 feet away, like you mentioned. And in addition to that, I read his autopsy report. I used to be in a heavy rescue squad. We didn't do a lot of car wrecks. We did mostly industrial, like mine rescue and that kind of thing. But I have seen enough car wrecks to know that the amount of damage to the right side of his body is not consistent with a forward wreck in a modern car with all of the airbags and restraints and everything like that. Literally, the right side of his body was just, you know, multiple bones broken in his foot, in his lower leg, in his upper leg, his pelvis, his internal organs jumbled horribly, his right arm in numerous places, the right side of his skull, the right side of his face. I mean, he experienced an explosion, not just gasoline makes a rapid burn. Gasoline does not explode. But he experienced an explosion and something, not just an impact in a modern, you know, one of the safest vehicles in the world, an expensive, safe vehicle. Those injuries to me are just not consistent with a head-on impact. It's more consistent considering the distance that the engine flew and considering, you know, LA has, monitoring devices all over it for earthquakes. I would love to know if there was a shockwave in that area at that time. That'd be an interesting thing to find out.
It certainly would, and unfortunately, it's one of those things that should have been followed up, but wasn't, along with the very interesting question about the Mercedes. Again, one of the safest cars that people generally actually do buy for its safety features, that it ended up in this giant raging inferno. And it's interesting that I only saw one reporter actually attempt to question Mercedes about this, and they said, well, we haven't been asked about this by the LAPD, so we're not going to comment. And there you go. So I guess Mercedes is perfectly happy to be associated with that flaming fireball, even though, of course, in their crash tests, I'm not sure it's ever been reported of that kind of violent ejection of the engine. Edition, which of course is designed to drop out of the chassis in that type of event, not to be thrown 100 feet down the street. But unfortunately, this story has also had its share of, false reports in blind alleys. There was someone who was reporting on this for one of the local television channels in San Diego, San Diego 6, Kim Dvorak, who has done some good work on this, but unfortunately also has contributed to some of the falsehoods surrounding this that have confused people about the story. I think she misspoke on one of her TV segments about the position of the engine relative to the car, which confused some people. And she also was the person who reported on this rumor that the body had been cremated against the family's wishes before an autopsy could take place, something that was specifically denied by not only the family themselves in a report on whowhatwhy.com from August 13th of this year, but also by Staff Sergeant Joe Biggs, who's been quite prominent in the media as one of Michael Hastings' friends, who's been talking about the fact that he believes Hastings was killed as a result of foul play of some sort. But he said also that that was completely flat out false. And unfortunately, that's gotten a lot of legs as well. So there's a lot of confusion surrounding the story, but at the end of the day, there's definitely something that needs to be investigated here. And one of the most puzzling and bizarre aspects of this was when Richard Clark, the former counterterrorism chief, came out and said, well, you know, there are intelligence agencies, including those of the United States, who can actually hack into cars these days and make them do things like this. And in fact, Hastings' crash was consistent with a car hacking, which is a pretty bizarre thing for an ex-counterterrorism czar to come out and say in the wake of an accident like this. Accident.
Yeah, and right in the same time frame, we've got Barnaby Jack dying, and I don't even know the direct circumstances involved in that, but I know that he was only 35 at the time of his death, and he had actually been working on the weaknesses in the car systems that allow hackers to do this kind of thing, to be able to remotely control a vehicle without actually having the keys for it or actually being inside of it. And he was getting ready to make a presentation on a totally different topic, but Barnaby Jack had the reputation of showing up at these conferences and then doing a presentation on something that nobody expected, that's, you know, way outside the box and way what people weren't expecting to happen. And so I thought, even at the time, I thought it was very unusual that that Barnaby Jack would just drop dead right before his presentation like that.
It is very interesting, isn't it? And in fact, it was shortly before he was going to be presenting on, basically he had successfully hacked into a pacemaker, and he was talking about hacked medical devices, and literally days before that conference, he was found dead in San Francisco, and at the time of the reports, the medical examiner was investigating the cause, and I've never seen a follow-up on that story, so I don't know if they ever did determine anything in that case, but at any rate, yes, just literally days before giving this presentation, he ends up dead, and it was literally just 2 weeks after the Hastings crash. So again, that is just another fascinating little piece of this puzzle.
And, you know, my mind goes back to a 70s revelation about the CIA, that they had dart guns and medication that could inject from a distance, could inject this poison into a person and cause them to have an immediate heart attack with no traces of the drug in their body. And that's from the 1970s.
Exactly right. And again, that's the type of thing people would roll their eyes about unless they actually watched the congressional testimony to the Church Commission, in which actually investigated this and found out about this. And it's, again, part of the documented record, but it sounds like crazy conspiracy theory. So I guess people will continue to treat it as such until they're told by, I don't know, the New York Times or whatever news source they trust that this is actually the truth. But again, it's just one of those things that makes it very, very difficult to come to a good understanding of these types of events, because that type of thing is not even on the radar of most people to even consider in an event like that. So when 35-year-olds drop dead the week before they make a very, very high profile and highly anticipated talk on the subject of hacking into medical devices, well, that's just taken as pure coincidence, I suppose.
Yeah. And without, you know, without the facts involved, it's hard for us to say anything intelligent about it without sounding like we're, you know, wearing a foil hat and living in a basement somewhere. But you know, this is not unusual. Assuming governments are guilty of the things that we're accusing here, this is really not unusual in a historical sense. You have talked recently about a thing that happened in Germany in the 1930s, where Polish prisoners were put in Polish army uniforms and then murdered, and then their bodies were dumped next to a radio station, and then the radio station was damaged, and the Germans blamed this on the Polish, and that was their excuse for invading Poland.
Exactly right. It was part of something called Operation Himmler, devised, of course, by Heinrich Himmler. And it was part of a concerted propaganda campaign that was taking place basically all of August 1939 in various ways to convince the German public that there was some sort of threat from Poland, that the Polish people were getting antsy, and the Polish army was threatening Germany, and it was getting more and more serious. And so it was a series of staged events, and it culminated in this attack, quote unquote, on Sender Gliwice, which was a German radio station right there near the Polish border. And exactly as you say, they rounded up some Polish prisoners, including one very prominent Polish anti-German agitator who was in jail, who had been captured by the Germans. But they dressed him up in a Polish army uniform along with several others, shot them dead, left them there at the station, took the pictures. There was a Polish language broadcast that was sent from the German radio station basically to say, we have your station, ha ha ha. And this was all presented as, oh, the Polish attacked us, so now we have to go to war. And literally the next day, Germany was at war with Poland, and of course World War II followed from that. So that was just one of, unfortunately, many, many, many such events that have been used time and time again by governments to lead their countries into war completely by deception and basically by convincing them that they'd been attacked by an enemy when in fact they hadn't.
And of course, it, you know, the first thing that happens when you refer to anything Nazi is that people in their mind, they think, well, but that was those really, really bad people from that one small group. And my government's not like that. Our government's not like this. Government is not like that. They would never do that. But then all you have to do is find out about the Gulf of Tonkin incident, and you see a situation where the American government essentially puts on a show, and then the American president comes out, makes these declarations which are entirely false, and that's the excuse, and the U.S. is in a war.
Exactly right. So this relates to the USS Maddox, which was a U.S. destroyer that was doing maneuvers there in the Gulf of Tonkin that experienced two events within the course of, I believe it was 3 days. And it came under attack from Vietnamese Navy torpedo boats and basically evaded their fire. And then a couple of days later, it happened again, and they spent a few dramatic hours evading these torpedoes that were being blasted at them and engaging the torpedo boats, and even sunk one of them. And these sailors returned, and they were heroes. And as a result, Johnson ordered some limited airstrikes over Vietnam, and then retroactively went to Congress to ask approval, and the Tonkin Resolution was passed, which was basically the formal beginning of the Vietnam War, although of course it was not a formal declaration of war, because there has been no such thing in the United States since the end of Second World War, but it was basically the commencement of open warfare against Vietnam. And then years later, as it turned out, there was most likely an actual attack on that first incident, but on the second incident, it never happened. And not only did it not happen, they knew within hours that nothing had actually been out there, that they genuinely thought they were under attack, but it was some radar echoes and or sonar echoes and the like. And basically they were overreacted, and the administration pounced on the opportunity. And in fact, it came out in 2005. Some documents were declassified to show that the NSA had manipulated their SIGINT information, their signals intelligence, to make it look like an attack had taken place. So the NSA deliberately manipulated that data. That's been released and declassified now. So we now know that at least the formal commencement of the Vietnam War, of course, the Americans had been in there since the 1950s with their military advisors getting deeper and deeper. But the formal commencement of the Vietnam War was itself based on a known and manipulated, consciously manipulated lie.
And then you start thinking about the lives destroyed from that war, and you think about how many American soldiers died over there, but how many came back horribly damaged. And not only that, but the damage done to the Vietnamese people is, I think the vast majority of Americans have no clue as to the devastation that took place with Agent Orange and the other chemicals and everything else that was dumped on those people over there. The long-term devastation from that, it'll bring tears to your eyes.
Unfortunately, just as in pretty much every combat situation, there's a very careful tally taken of every American or one of our guys that gets injured or killed, but no tally at all of the other side. And just like Iraq, a couple of decades later, there's only sort of vague estimates of how many people were killed that range anywhere from the hundreds of thousands to over a million. And again, it's just one of those things people just have to shrug their shoulders at because there's no way to come to a conclusion about it. Unfortunately, with Iraq, and when we talk about weapons that cause horrible disfigurements and the like, we start talking about the depleted uranium that was used in the first Gulf War and in the second Gulf War. And then we start talking about what happened, for example, in Fallujah. And it turns out that the WHO, the World Health Organization, has in fact been actively opposing the publication of their own research into the effects of these weapons in places like Fallujah, that in fact independent teams have found that there are the highest rates of birth defects that have ever been found in any population in the history of the world that has ever been documented, has been found in certain areas of Iraq where these weapons were used. And this information has been actively suppressed by the WHO for years. In fact, going back to at least 2004, when the first expert report was created by the WHO, but immediately suppressed and was in fact never released. They very, very recently released a certain section of one of their reports on this matter, but still basically the bulk of the data is under lock and key. And that's exactly what happens in these warfare situations. And unfortunately, the data will probably continue to be sequestered until such time as it's no longer a politically hot topic and people can just basically shrug and go, well, that was what people were like back then. But now our government's different. It's a different group that's in charge these days, exactly as we look back at what happened in the Gulf of Tonkin or any of the previous events. And we think, well, that was just a different era and there were different people. But now it's different when our people are in charge, whoever we want to define our people as.
Again, more of the accepting of the situation we're in and deciding not to even try to move out of the way, just sit there and take the shock and, decide, well, there's nothing we can do anyway, so we might as well approve of it.
Well, again, it keeps going back down to that fundamental question of the consciousness of ourselves when it comes to confronting these very difficult issues. And I appreciate that they are difficult issues, and I appreciate that it truly does take a paradigm shift for people to be able to really look at this information unflinchingly and to really follow the data where it leads, because it's an extremely uncomfortable thing to think about the idea that that you have been lied to your entire life about the nature and structure of the people who are in these positions of political power and what their interests are and how this really functions. I mean, when you start peeling back the layers and see that it is just one manipulated fraud after another in a seemingly infinite chain of abuses that shows no sign of abating anytime in the near future. It is one of those things that will make you either retreat in further into that shell and that bubble of unreality that is very easy to live in, given all of the cultural and educational programming we're subjected to, or you can confront that directly head on. And unfortunately, we'll have a much more difficult time of it as you start being shunned by all of those around you who suddenly don't want to hear about these types of things. Oh, who cares? I mean, that was 10 years ago. That was in Iraq. What does that matter to me? And unfortunately, as I say, there's a very small percentage of the population that can basically take this information on board, look at it unflinchingly, and then continue to act upon it and not to basically coalesce to the learned helplessness or the Stockholm syndrome or the various other reactions that a lot of people have to this.
James, I want to thank you for coming on the show with me today, and I want to give a quick shout out again to your websites. James Corbett from the Corbett Report, also from BoilingFrogsPost.com, host of the Boiling Frogs Post Eye Opener Report, and I'll provide links in today's show notes to the things that we're talking about, with including the YouTube video 9/11, a conspiracy theory. Folks, seriously, you need to follow that link and watch this video. And if you have somebody who's a bit skeptical about 9/11, have them watch the video, and it's well worth it. James, thanks a ton for coming on the show with me. I really appreciate your time.
Thank you for having me on. Happy to be back anytime you need me.
Thanks a lot, James.